Hello, this is Terry Burdick, reading to you today from the Vermilion County Commercial News, the weekend edition, for January 11th and 12th. Well, I think we should start on the first page, and I know that this is not news to you, but we had our first real measurable snow this weekend, and on the front page of the paper today is a picture of a man using a Capota utility vehicle to clear a parking lot in Danville on Friday. According to the National Weather Service, Vermilion County saw 2.5 inches of snow as of 6 p.m. Friday, and the area could see an additional dusting of snow by Monday. In our headlines on the front page today, District 118 Working to Overcome Nationwide Teacher Shortage by Kayla White of the Danville Commercial News. This is the first in a two-part series on the teacher shortage across the state of Illinois. In step with a nationwide teacher shortage, education administrators in Illinois are feeling the pinch. Of school leaders, 84% in the state claim to be dealing with minor, serious, or very serious problem with teacher shortages, according to a 2024 report by the Illinois State Board of Education and the Illinois Association of Regional Superintendents of Schools. According to Markeisha Parker, the Assistant Director of Human Resources at District 118 in Danville, there are 13 total teaching positions within the district currently being filled by long-term substitutes who are not educators, but have become certified through the state. Matters grew worse after the COVID-19 pandemic, with many teachers opting for an online position rather than returning to school, according to Parker. Parker and her team are working diligently to remedy the district's teaching shortage, she said. We've been lucky enough to be blessed with a teacher vacancy grant, so we've been able to focus on recruitment and retention, Parker said, adding that they've also been attending digital job fairs and tapping into other resources like a national database of certified teachers through Education Week. Of the 13 long-term subs, 2 are retired educators, while 6 others are currently in college completing their teaching degrees and certificates. We're always seeking to find qualified teachers to replace our long-term substitutes, Parker said. There are several perks of joining the district, according to Parker, including a $1,000 benefit to allow for purchasing materials. Though the district typically requires its long-term subs to hold bachelor's degrees, in rare instances they will approve the certification of someone holding only an associate's degree, as long as they have some previous experience. Over the last several years, the district has also been working with high school seniors and teacher assistants in their Grow Your Own program. When they express an interest in teaching in the district works with them to help support their education. We provide financial support for college credits with the requirement that they return to the district and teach for a period, Parker said, adding that the required teaching term could be up to 5 years. We follow them throughout their college career, trying to stay in constant communication in hopes they decide to choose Danville, Parker said. In the coming years, the district foresees several teachers retiring, especially coming into the 2026-2027 academic year. The district is betting on their hopes to see several of those who participated in the Grow Your Own program graduate and begin teaching in the district. A Danville alum herself, Parker said she knew when she graduated college that she wanted to come back to Danville and teach. It's the family feel, the way teachers care for our students and work very hard to try to reach every student where they are, Parker said. Danville's a district that teachers love and should want to be part of. Having taken an opportunity outside the district, which took her away for 4 years, Parker said she returned to the district afterward. I always knew that I wanted to come back home to bring the knowledge I'd gained back to this community, Parker said. When people begin a new long-term substitute job in District 118, training includes observing district math and reading coaches as they model teach, as well as leaning on other staff to give them a good start. Other teachers will mentor those new substitutes to help get them going. Staff in the building and at the district level wrap around these people for support to help them be the best classroom teacher they can be, Parker said. Anyone with a bachelor's degree may apply for a long-term substitute position. Those interested can check out open positions on the district's website at danvilleK12.tedk12 or reach out to Parker directly at area code 217-444-1074. Continuing on the front page, and continuing with reporter Kayla White, the headline, City of Danville Waiting for Funding to Demolish Partially Collapsed Buildings. 2 Danville buildings should be demolished sooner rather than later, pending funding, according to Director of Public Works David Rue. The facade of the city-owned building located at 129 North Vermilion Street in downtown Danville was partially demolished by the city in December when it was discovered that the roof had mostly fallen in, Rue said. During the inspection of a neighboring building, we found that the roof was collapsed quite significantly. We took care of the safety hazard at that point in time, Rue said, adding that the only delay on further demolition of the building comes down to the lack of funding. Another building, located at 17 North Jackson, was previously home to Model Star Laundry. The building caught fire in the early morning hours of October 31st of 2024. The cleanup from that project is also delayed pending funding. Both projects depend on leftover funds set aside for the Breezy Tower demolition project. The city accepted a bid from Homrick Wrecking out of Carlton, Michigan for the project on December 3, 2024. The Vermilion County Board must now draft and approve their own budget for their portion of the project as laid out in the intergovernmental agreement between the City of Danville and the county. Their first meeting of the year for the County Board will be held at 6 p.m. Tuesday, January 14th in the Vermilion County Administration Building at 201 Vermilion Street in Danville. Sounds like those projects should be coming to a closure soon. Our final article on the front page today is Encouraging People Through Song, Danville to Honor Longtime Music Director Brett Dupree at MLK Celebration, again by Kayla White. For more than 25 years, Brett Dupree has had his back to the audience, directing the MLK Mass Choir, a group of singers based in Vermilion County who perform at the annual Martin Luther King Jr. Day celebration in Danville. This year, Dupree will stand in the spotlight as the MLK Jr. Celebration Committee honors him for his many years of dedication. His love for music and love for the community sets him apart, Sandra Finch, Director of Human Resources for the City of Danville, said of Dupree. He makes a way to help with any type of event, and he's always been a kind person as well as an excellent musician. A Danville native, Dupree has been passionate about making music since he was quite young. They say when I was 3 years old, my aunt used to watch me, and I'd bang on her piano and sing, "Oh, Happy Day," but I don't remember that, Dupree said. His interest in making music was sparked when he was a teenager attending the old Danville Union Baptist Church and watched a lady playing piano. That was also the beginning of a long and storied professional gospel singing career for Dupree. Aside from directing several choirs over the years, he also plays piano and organ weekly at both Carter Metropolitan CME Church and Second Baptist Church in Danville. When Sandra Houston reached out to Dupree more than 25 years ago to invite him to direct the MLK Mass Choir, he was honored. Back then, the choir was much larger with many more singers. Since the COVID-19 pandemic, the number of singers has diminished, but not their talent or passion for performance. It's more exciting every year that I get to participate in this celebration to remember Dr. King for what he has done, Dupree said, and hopefully these celebrations go down in history. As for this year's celebration, Dupree is confident it will be a good experience for all. I hope it's going to be a great day, a great celebration, Dupree said. I'm hoping to give out the songs that will give encouragement, that people will reach the word through song. Among the songs the MLK Choir plans to perform Monday, January 20th at St. James United Methodist Church will be Precious Jesus and How Excellent Is Your Name. The MLK Junior Celebration will begin with a march and motorcade leaving from the corner of Gilbert and Main Streets at 10:30 on January 20th, heading northeast toward the church. The service will begin at 11:30 a.m. on January 20th and will feature Reverend Dr. Crystal Thomas, who's the senior pastor at New Zion Tabernacle of Fort Wayne, Indiana. One senior graduating this year from Danville High School will be presented with the $6,000 MLK Junior Scholarship during the service as well. As we move on to page 2, the state's attorney clears Danville man of murder charge. This is a staff report. Daryl Boston has been cleared of murder charges, the Vermilion County State's attorney announced on Thursday, January 9th. On January 2nd, Boston was charged with first-degree murder in the death of Joseph Jones, a Danville resident who was killed December 21, 2024. Danville police issued a press release stating that Boston had been charged with the first-degree murder and had been arrested. During the continued diligent investigation by the Danville Police Department, new evidence was uncovered which has negated the evidence against Daryl Boston. As justice requires, the murder charges against Daryl Boston have been dismissed, State's Attorney Jacqueline Lacey said. The newly discovered evidence is being assessed and reviewed by the Danville Police Department and the Vermilion County State's Attorney's Office. Illinois Rules of Professional Responsibility and the Illinois Rules of Evidence require the prosecution and the police to continuously disclose to the defense throughout the course of any prosecution any new evidence that is discovered. When a prosecutor knows of new, credible, and material evidence creating a reasonable likelihood that a defendant did not commit the offense, The prosecutor must remedy the circumstances, Lacey said. Once new evidence is discovered, justice requires in any criminal prosecution that the prosecutor, in cooperation with the police, evaluate the new evidence and determine if the prosecution can move forward to trial. The Danville Police Department and the Vermilion County State's Attorney's Office are still investigating Jones' murder. In the state of Illinois, the charge of first-degree murder has no statute of limitations. Let's broaden our look a bit and take a look at what's going on around our state. This headline made me smile. Illinois declares the soybean as official state bean. On January 6th, the Illinois legislature passed HB 4439, so that's House Bill, which designates the soybean as Illinois' official state bean. HB 4439 recognizes the importance of soybeans to the state's economy and agricultural heritage. Illinois is the number one soybean producing state in the nation, with over 10 million acres of soybeans planted each year, accounting for 16% of the total U.S. soy production, a news release states. HB 4439 acknowledges the contribution of the 43,000 hardworking soybean farmers across the state who feed and fuel the world. I'd like to extend our gratitude to Representative Matt Hansen and the Illinois General Assembly for officially designating the soybean as the state bean of Illinois. This bill helps raise awareness of the importance of soybeans to our state's economy and agricultural sector, said Andrew Larson, the Director of Government Relations and Strategy at the Illinois Soybean Association. We thank Representative Hansen for his work highlighting the importance Illinois farmers play to our state. HB 4439 will be sent to the governor's office to await his signature. Well, let's return to something, I guess, that's a little bit closer to home. I apologize, I got a little out of order there. I guess I was excited about that soybean article. Carl sets mask visitor guidelines to reduce spread of infection. Changes impact all locations as all service areas reach high rates of respiratory illness. Carle Health has set mask and visitor restrictions in place due to the increased spread of respiratory illness in the area. Carle Health remains committed to creating the safest environment possible to give and receive care. As the respiratory illness rates reach high levels in every part of our coverage area, the organization is taking steps to update personal protective equipment, use the terminology PPE, and visitor guidelines to reduce the spread of illness among team members and the community. We urge all patients and visitors experiencing respiratory illness symptoms to wear a mask while at care facilities, a new news release states. Visitors to any Carle hospital must be 18 years or older and are limited to two at a time in a patient room. The shift is to help support a safer care environment in Carle Health facilities throughout this most intense respiratory illness season and work to reduce the spread of infection to team members and those we serve, the release continued. As we have in previous years during peak respiratory illness season, Carle Health reviews our PPE and visitor guidelines to take every measure possible to limit the spread of infection, Robert Healy, MD, Carle Health Quality, Patient Safety, and Patient Experience Medical Director said. We have an expert team of infection preventionists who continually monitor metrics for diseases like the flu, RSV, COVID-19, and others. This, along with national and state centers for disease control and prevention metrics and industry best practices, help us decide when it's time to update our guidelines. Studies have shown the positive impact masks and reducing exposure can offer to lessen the transmission of viral diseases. Taking these temporary measures will help all community members stay well, especially those most at risk like the young, elderly, the immunocompromised, according to Carle professionals. The Illinois Department of Public Health recently issued a recommendation to state health care providers to take additional mitigation measures to combat the increasing rates of respiratory illness. Our care teams continue to encounter an increasing rate of these respiratory infections, so we know firsthand that this national trend is also reflected here locally. With everything we know about how to mitigate the spread of disease, these safeguards will help keep more people in our community well, Healy said. Carle Health experts will continue to evaluate respiratory illnesses in the region and provide an update when levels reach a point where the temporary restrictions can be lifted. In addition to taking steps to reduce transmission while at our facilities, we encourage all community members to remember the mitigation efforts that have been proven to slow the circulation of illness. People should stay mindful throughout the season to maintain good hand hygiene, wear a mask when symptomatic, and stay home. For more information about visitor guidelines at Carle Health facilities, visit carle.org. In a related article by Andrea Vale from Stacker News, extreme weather events put older adults at risk. Over the past two decades, extreme weather events and record-breaking temperatures fueled by climate change have put more lives at risk. In the United States and around the world, hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, and heat waves have become more frequent, intense, and deadly. But for America's most vulnerable populations, including older adults, these catastrophic weather events pose a heightened threat. Just look at Florida, where in October, Hurricanes Helene and Milton hit back-to-back. Milton, which made landfall as a Category 3 storm, hit the Gulf Coast on October 10th. Months after making landfall, residents are still wrangling with the damage. While the exact cost is yet to be determined, officials expect Milton to surpass $50 billion in damages. It caused dozens of deaths, both from its direct impact and the multiple tornadoes triggered in its wake. Among those most impacted were the residents of retirement communities and nursing homes. Florida ranks second after Maine among states with the highest percentages of adults 65 and older. The rise in deadly natural disasters aligns with a surge in America's aging population. The number of Americans older than 65 will jump from 58 million in 2022 to 82 million by 2050, according to the Census Bureau estimates, representing nearly a quarter of the entire population. Caring.com examined data from the National Weather Service, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the Census to determine how natural disasters are impacting seniors. Extreme weather events put older adults at risk. They often face limited mobility, impaired hearing, and poor vision, making it much harder to evacuate quickly. Older adults may lack access to a social support system, reliable transportation, phones, and the internet. To complicate matters further, many areas most vulnerable to natural disasters are popular with retirees. The intersection of climate risk and large concentrations of older people is no coincidence. The same factors that make these coastal locations with warmer climates appealing to retirees are the factors that make these spots susceptible to extreme weather. The increase in extreme weather combined with an aging population means more Americans will know an older American in emergencies or be one in one themselves. Severe weather-related fatalities on the rise. As weather events get more severe, so too does their fallout. About 575 people die annually from severe weather events, with fatalities peaking in 2021 and 2022, according to CDC data. That figure accounts for fatalities from all types of weather events, but extreme heat is the most deadly. Since 1979, over 14,000 Americans have died as a direct result of causes related to heat, according to the EPA. 2021 and 2022 were two of the hottest years in recent history, with several heat waves resulting in record-breaking number of heat-related deaths. For older people, extreme heat is a major cause for concern. This population is particularly vulnerable to heat because it interacts with pre-existing or underlying conditions. Since 1999, retirement-age people have been several times more likely to die from heat than their younger peers due to cardiovascular disease. Hurricanes, western wildfires, and a southern cold freeze in 2021 also contributed to the rising death toll, with some disasters causing more hardship to older adults than others. Hurricane Eden struck Florida's coast in September 2022, causing 120 fatalities, among which 2 in 3 were 60 or older, according to FEMA. Older adults also face multiple vulnerabilities during extreme weather events. For instance, they're more likely to rely on specialized equipment, including ventilators or oxygen machines. A hurricane or flood wiping out a region's electricity puts older individuals at instant risk. They are also more susceptible to hypothermia, overheating, and other temperature-related conditions. Evacuating to safety or avoiding dangerous areas can also be more challenging due to mobility issues, and that's just the general population above 65. For those with specific disabilities or health conditions, the loss of access to medicine or interruptions to healthcare services can be catastrophic. Historical health data also reveals racial disparities in heat-related deaths in the U.S. In a 2024 study published in the journal One Earth, researchers analyzing decades of data confirmed that extreme heat disproportionately impacts non-Hispanic black residents more than non-Hispanic white residents, which they attribute to systematic issues, including higher rates of non-Hispanic black people living in heat islands. Examining 2022, one of the hottest years on record, the paper's authors suggest the excess death rate in non-Hispanic black people is twice the rate of that of non-Hispanic white residents. These racial inequalities increase the risk for older individuals who are non-Hispanic black. Also, some regions are more impacted than others. To determine which areas across the country are more at risk for negative repercussions from extreme weather, FEMA's National Risk Index combines data on 18 natural hazards and a community risk factors, creating a baseline risk measurement for each county in the U.S. Overall, coastal areas in the U.S., including Florida, California, Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, tend to rank higher on FEMA's risk index than inland areas. States west of Iowa and Missouri tend to be at a higher risk than those on the country's eastern side. Florida is one of the most at-risk states in the nation, with clearly every county ranking very high, or relatively moderate in danger. Of the top 10 riskiest counties based on FEMA scores, 9 are in Florida, and 5 of those counties have an over 65 population of at least a third. Outside the state, the highest risk counties include Brunswick County, North Carolina, Beaufort County, South Carolina, Cape May County, New Jersey, and Coos County, Oregon. Older adults and their caretakers can take preventive measures to prevent the worst when extreme weather hits. For those living in areas prone to tornadoes, floods, and hurricanes, establishing phone trees or other emergency contact systems with neighbors and loved ones can help keep older adults on the radar of those who can come to their aid. Check-ins throughout an emergency, evacuation checklist, at least a month's worth of medications, extra batteries, and medical equipment can also build resistance in an emergency. The Red Cross advises maintaining an updated list of medical conditions, medications, allergies, and emergency contacts. It's crucial that older adults learn how their specific medical conditions might be exacerbated by winter conditions. For instance, diabetes and thyroid problems can both make it even more difficult to regulate the body's temperature. As the winter months approach, even non-emergency conditions can pose risks for older adults. Ice and snow can hinder access to critical services, so always keep entryway stairs and ramps clearly de-iced and dry. Older people and those around them should know the signs of hypothermia, including pale skin and slurred speech, as well as how to preserve heat indoors in case of power outage. Safe generator usage and closing off unused rooms are two places to start. With extreme weather forecasts to worsen, now is the time to put an action plan in place. The story originally appeared in caring.com and was produced and distributed in partnership with Stacker Studio. Well, we're a little past our halfway mark, but this is a time that we're going to take a look at today's obituaries. Carolyn Jean Brady. Carolyn Jean Lenover Brady, 95, of Grayson, Georgia, formerly of Danville, passed away Monday, January 6, 2025. A service to celebrate the life of Carolyn Jean Brady will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, January 17th at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center at 3940 North Vermilion Street in Danville. The Reverend Dr. Donald Jackson will officiate. Burial will follow at Spring Hill Cemetery, and visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. on Friday prior to the service, also at Sunset in Danville. Please join Jean's family in sharing memories on her tribute wall at www.sunsetfuneralhome.com. Michael Dale Hank. Michael Dale Hank, 82 of Danville, passed away with his children by his side at 10:28 p.m. on January 7th at Carl Foundation Hospital. A celebration of life will be held at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, January 14th at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Danville. Pastor Ken Tibben will officiate. Burial will be at Sunset Memorial Park. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Monday the 13th at the funeral home. Stanley Clark. Stanley Clark of Covington, Indiana, will have a visitation held on Tuesday, January 14th from 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at Cayuga Christian Church, with a memorial service officiated by Pastor Kurt Smith at 5 p.m. Sunset's Diverter Chapel assisted the family. That concludes our reading of today's obituaries. Let's go back to other news in the state. Potawatomi land transfer clears General Assembly by Peter Hancock of the Capital News, Illinois. Nearly two centuries after losing its reservation in Illinois in a land sale that most people now conceded was illegal, the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation could soon get its land back. In the final hours of a lame duck session Tuesday, the Illinois House gave final approval to a bill authorizing the state to hand over to the tribe a 1,500-acre state park in DeKalb County, land that largely overlaps the tribe's original reservation. "You know, this has been a struggle," Tribal Chairman Joseph Zeke Rupnick said in an interview in the Statehouse Rotunda while waiting for the House to take up the bill. Senate Bill 867 is the culmination of nearly 20 years of negotiations between the tribe and the state. It authorizes the director of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources to deliver a quitclaim deed to the tribe for land that currently makes up the Shabana Lake and State Park. The transfer of land, however, would be contingent on the state and tribe executing a land management agreement under which the park would continue to be operated as a park and open to the public. If there's no agreement, there's no transfer. Representative Will Guzzardi, Democrat of Chicago, the bill's chief House sponsor, said during floor debate, "The land does not get transferred with the passage of this bill. It is pending a land management agreement to keep the park a park." The Potawatomi Indians once occupied much of the Great Lakes region, but they were gradually displaced by growing European settlements. In 1829, the Treaty of Prairie du Chien granted the Prairie Band Potawatomi 2 square miles, or 1,280 acres, in what is now DeKalb County. According to Rupnik, Chief Chabanet, after whom the park was named, and several members of his extended family lived on that reservation. But after passage of the Indian Removal Act of 1830, many other tribal members left Illinois, eventually settling in northeast Kansas, where the tribe is now headquartered. But around 1849, Chabanet traveled west to Kansas to check on the status of tribal members there. While he was gone, the federal government declared the reservation land abandoned and sold it at public auction. The legality of that sale, however, has always been in doubt because under federal law, tribal land cannot be sold except by an act of Congress. And since Congress never authorized that sale and the tribe has never relinquished its claim to the land, all deed and titles to that land have been legally clouded. Most of the original reservation is now part of the state park, which the state acquired in the 1960s, but some portions of the original reservation are now occupied by private owners. Rupnik said the tribe's efforts to reestablish a reservation in Illinois began in 2006 when it purchased about 130 acres of farmland that had once been part of the original reservation. It also began petitioning the U.S. Department of Interior to take the land into trust as reservation property, which the agency finally did in April of 2024. Once we started meeting with lawmakers down here in Springfield, they realized that a majority of the original reservation was a part of the state park. So DNR at the time said, "Well, since this is part of the reservation, what would you guys do if we said, let's turn it over to you?" And I said, "We'll take it." Rupnik said, "And state legislation will go a long way toward permanently satisfying the tribe's land claims in Illinois." In addition to pushing the SB 87, which now awaits Governor J.B. Pritzker's signature, the Prairie Band Potawatomi are also seeking federal legislation that would settle the tribe's claims to the remaining land on the original reservation site in exchange for a cash payment that would allow them to repurchase land currently in private hands. Being on the House floor, Guzzardi said passage of the bill would be a small step toward correcting a historic injustice committed in America 175 years ago. "I firmly believe that for all of our problems, America is the greatest country on earth, and I'm proud to be an American," he said. "But I also don't think that the answer is to turn a blind eye to the violence and the ugliness of our past, to rewrite the history books, to gloss over the unpleasant parts. I think the answer is to look our past square in the eye, the good stuff and the bad stuff. And when we recognize that we've done wrong as a nation, to see it, own it, and find some ways where we can make it right." Well, it's winter. So what is the biggest news in our lives? It's really about the weather. So let's finish up the last few moments that we have together today by taking a look at our forecast for this week. I will give you the short news. It's going to be cold. I mean, like really, really cold. So on Monday, that would be Monday the 13th, your high is going to be 20 degrees and a low of 8 with an overview of breezy and very cold. Tuesday, kind of the same thing, but colder yet, with a high of 16 degrees and a low of -1. On Wednesday, it'll be frigid with plenty of sun. There's the positive part. Wednesday with a high of 15 and a low of 10 degrees. Thursday, again, cold, but warming up. It's partly sunny, very cold, high of 22 degrees, low of 17. And on Friday, I think this is our heat wave of the day. It's turning cloudy, but the gift is it gets to be a little warmer, with a high of 30 degrees and a low of 27. It doesn't look like we're in store for any snow this week, but I pray that you all stay warm. And I will read with you again next week. This has been Terry Burdick reading the weekend edition of the Commercial News, and I hope and look forward to reading again with you soon. Have a great week.